Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on today's show, my co-host John Dorney and I are joined by Dr. Shane Kenna. Shane's research interests are Victorian Ireland, Britain and America, and his first book, War in the Shadows, The Irish-American Fenians Who Bombed Victorian Britain, will be published this September by Merriam Press. On today's show, we're going to discuss the Irish National Invincibles and the Fenian Dynamite Campaign in Britain in the 1880s. You're very welcome to the show, Shane.
Thanks very much, Cathal.
What was the political context to the rise of the Invincibles in the 1880s?
Well, in terms of the society in which the Invincibles grow up in the 1880s, it's a very different society to the Ireland today. Ireland is governed by a small-scale bureaucracy at Dublin Castle. The head of the small-scale bureaucracy, the Viceroy, in this period it's the Earl Cowper. Then we have a Chief Secretary, who's the governmental face of Irish policy. This governmental face of Irish policy, the Chief Secretary, is a man called William Forster. Under William Forster, you have an Under-Secretary at Dublin Castle. And the Under-Secretary at Dublin Castle really is the most senior civil servant in the country. And his name is Thomas Henry Burke. And Thomas Henry Burke was the man who was in charge of the basic day-to-day administration of Ireland. By the late 1870s, early 1880s, there's a bad harvest. It's the worst harvest on record since the famine. And this is the question of questions in Ireland. Emigration is now seen on a scale not witnessed since the famine. There's increasing eviction on a scale not witnessed since the famine. You're going to find that increasingly tenant farmers are worried that the famine is going to come back again. They now are increasingly radicalised and they set up their own organisation under the effective leadership of the likes of Charles Stewart Parnell, the leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party, also under Michael Davitt, himself formerly of the IRB Supreme Council. And this organisation they set up is called the Land League. And the ambition of the Land League is to fight for tenant, for farmer rights. Out of this, there's a major social conflict that will take place between 1878 to 1882. And this conflict was called the Irish Land War. Now, the Land War will be a major social revolution that will increasingly change the entire face of land ownership within the country. As a result of this increasing land war that's taking place, this social conflict, the British government is determined to suppress the Land League. Its means of suppressing the Land League is by means of coercion, which is referred to as the Protection of Person and Property Act, which will result in any individual that's suspected of criminal activity, subversive activity, agrarian activity. They're likely to be arrested. They're likely to be interned in jails, such as Kilmainham Jail. You're also going to find that there'll be a conciliatory approach as well. And the conciliatory approach is called Gladstone's Second Land Act. Gladstone's Second Land Act is a good deal for tenant farmers. It sets up a land court. The problem is, however, if you're a tenant farmer in arrears, or if you can't afford to pay your rent to your landlord, you can't use the land court. Parnell denounces part of the Second Land Act, but he's willing to support it if it falls into difficulty. Equally, on the other side of it as well, Parnell introduces a policy of testing the land court. Eventually, however, there's going to be spiralling violence in the country as a result of this land war that's taken place. There's going to be assassinations throughout the countryside of land grabbers, of land agents, of landlords, of gombeen men. There's going to be cattle maiming that's taken place throughout the country as well. You're going to find now that the British government will use the powers that's given to it under coercion to arrest all these leading figures in the Land League. By the 13th of October 1881, Parnell himself will have been arrested and he's interned inside of Kilmainham Jail. Now, against this background, we have a three-man committee known as a Directory of Three that's based in London. And this Directory of Three, which includes Frank Byrne, the Secretary of the Land League of Great Britain, is increasingly beginning to argue that maybe we should inaugurate a policy of assassination against leading figures within the Dublin Castle administration. You're now going to find as well that they send over a man to Ireland called John Walsh. John Walsh was a Middlesbrough Fenian who was quite active in the Fenian movement. Walsh comes over to Dublin to work within the Fenian network to establish a Fenian assassination squad, the purpose of which was essentially to make history, to make the Dublin Castle administration a living nightmare by assassinating all these leading figures within the castle and by undermining the very nature of the system of the government in Ireland. In many respects, it's quite similar to Michael Collins in the 1920s, you know, the guerrilla strategy that Collins had, that you keep attacking the castle, you make it the case that the castle becomes essentially a fortress, in the sense that it's dangerous for them to come outside of the castle. In some respects, that's what the Invincibles themselves wanted to achieve. But through a number of figures in the Fenian movement in Dublin City, Walsh gets in touch with James Carey. James Carey was a town councillor. James Carey is one of the leading Fenian activists. James Carey is involved with the Home Manufacturer Association. Kerry is also involved with a campaign for Irish workers' rights as well. There's a Scottish contractor who will be brought over to Ireland to build sewers. James Kerry will continuously harangue and attack this man, and he will make his name out of that, arguing that essentially the contract to build these sewers should have been given to the Irish people themselves. He was also involved, rather ironically enough, with a vigilance committee, the purpose of which was to extract informers from within the Fenian movement by making examples to others. Now, the Invincible Society, as it was set up, it was supposed to number no more than 50 people in Dublin City. Kerry will bring in a good few people. Also on the other side, a man called Daniel Curley will also get involved. Daniel Curley will bring in over 20 people, including a man called Joseph Brady. And Joseph Brady was a stonecutter from inner city Dublin. He was born in North King Street. The beauty of Joe Brady was that he was the oldest of 27 children, if you can imagine that in that regard. So kind of...
It's a lot of potential recruits.
I'd say to him, get a job. You know? But in terms of Brady's involvement, Brady brings in to the Invincibles Tim Kelly. He's an apprentice coach builder by trade. Brady was essentially the circle. Brady was the secretary of Daniel Curley's Fenian circle. Daniel Curley was a Fenian centre. You also have a figure called Michael Fagan who comes in. Michael Fagan is another Fenian centre. And these men will all form the nucleus of an assassination society. And this assassination society really is set up to make history. Now, this period that essentially we're looking at in terms of the 1880s, the Invincibles, the Fenian Dynamite campaign, it's really underlined by this idea that's called a war of attrition. Irish America, in particular at this time, is very staunchly talking about this idea of a war of attrition, that you use any kind of weapon in defence of liberty, whether it's bombs, whether it's poison, whether it's knives. Once it's used in defence of liberty, that's seen as legitimate. Now, against the background of the Invincibles and the Dynamiters, you have coercion, the Protection of Person and Property Act. Now, the Protection of Person and Property Act really is seen by Irish America as an act of tyranny against the people. And this is defined with an ideas of American republicanism as you have a right. If you're a citizen of a nation, you have a right to take an arm up. You have a right to arm yourself against tyranny. Mm. You have a right to defend yourself in the name of liberty. Now, in many respects, this is the school that the Invincibles are also emerging from as well. Now, the Invincibles will try and assassinate Forster, and they will also try and assassinate Cowper on 19 separate occasions. Each occasion is more or less a failure. Some occasions will be a failure as a result of the presence of Cowper's wife or daughters in the area, or just several figures within the Invincibles refusing to give the signal to actually execute or kill this man. Many of the figures in it will have been kind of strong-armed into joining the Invincible Society as well themselves. They would have been reluctant Invincibles. Now, inside the Kilmainham jail, you have Charles Stuart Parnell, who will be released on the 2nd of May, 1882.
He's been arrested under the Coercion Act.
Now, Charles Stuart Parnell really wants to get out of Kilmainham jail. Charles Stuart Parnell, his girlfriend, Catherine O'Shea, has just had a child. That child is called Claude Sophie. The child has died quite early on. Parnell is desperate to get out of the jail. Now, behind the scenes, there's also negotiation through Parnell's mistress's husband, a man called Captain William O'Shea. Now, Captain William O'Shea will secure from the British government an understanding, and this understanding is known as the Kilmainham Treaty. To call it a treaty is in fact quite wrong. There is no treaty in existence. Now, the Kilmainham Treaty is an understanding that Parnell will be released from Kilmainham jail on the basis that he will use his influence to quell growing land agitation within the country. He will also be released from Kilmainham jail if he follows a new alliance in Irish politics. This new alliance in Irish politics will be between the Liberal Party and the Irish Parliamentary Party. Gladstone, for his part, will now open the land court to those tenant farmers and arrears who cannot afford to pay their rent. William Forster is now horrified by the concept that Charles Stuart Parnell has been released from Kilmainham jail. He resigns in protest. As a result, he's not going to come back to Ireland. He's now replaced by a new team. This new team includes the Earl of Spencer. The Earl of Spencer is a distant relative of Diana Spencer. It also includes Lord Frederick Cavendish, the husband of Gladstone's niece, Lucy. Lord Frederick Cavendish is a political novice. Lord Frederick Cavendish is also a bad speaker. He's damaged by a stutter. Freddie Cavendish will arrive in Ireland on the 6th of May, 1882. When he arrives on the 6th of May, 1882, there's a big ceremony that's due to take place in Dublin Castle. This ceremony is due to take place in the throne room. Within a couple of hours, Freddie Cavendish will literally be torn to pieces. He will be assassinated in Dublin's Phoenix Park. Freddie Cavendish will decide to leave the Phoenix Park by foot. This is not an unusual thing. He'll walk with no security around him. He'll walk with no police around him. He'll walk straight to his residence in the Phoenix Park. This is done quite regularly within the Victorian era. You don't need security guards to follow you in your movements. Gladstone himself, the Prime Minister, always found it as worse than actually being suspected by the police for a crime to be followed by the police. It was an intrusion on one's life and one's lifestyle. When he's in the Phoenix Park, a cab will pull up beside him. Out of this cab will arrive a man called Thomas Henry Burke, the most senior civil servant within the country. Thomas Henry Burke will decide to walk with Lord Frederick Cavendish down the Phoenix Park, down Chesterfield Avenue. As they're walking down Chesterfield Avenue, they're approached by several men. There are three men in front, two men in the middle, and two behind. As they walk through the first three men walk on a little bit further. They then begin to turn, and they walk behind Lord Frederick Cavendish and Thomas Henry Burke. The men in the middle are Joseph Brady and Timothy Kelly, two of the actual assassins. The whole idea is, if they pass through Timothy Kelly and Joe Brady, then they're going to be met by the two other men who are behind Kelly and Brady. These two other men were Patrick Delaney, also a man called Thomas Caffrey, and they would then be assassinated. As they're passing beyond Kelly and Brady, a cab passes by, and Kelly loads to Brady, "Do not do this yet." Brady now bends down as if he's tying his shoelace. As the cab passes by Frederick Cavendish and Thomas Henry Burke, Brady now grabs him by the hips. He now stabs him with an 11-inch knife. He cuts his throat. He stabs him just above the hip. The assassinations are incredibly brutal. They're an incredibly bloody assassination. Kelly himself will then take care of Lord Frederick Cavendish afterwards as well. Again, more or less the same, that the throats will be cut, they will be torn to pieces. Now, you're going to find in the aftermath of the Phoenix Park assassinations, there's a major police investigation. The manhunt is headed by an Irishman from Meath in South Armagh. His name is Inspector John Mallon of the Dublin Metropolitan Police. Mallon knows who committed the assassinations. He knows exactly who it is. He can't touch them, however. As a result, he's no evidence to get them. He knows exactly who they are. They are wanted men in the city. He's very frustrated at this stage. Mallon, however, is blessed by means of the Invincibles growing increasingly cocky. The Invincibles decide that they're going to continue their attacks on all these leading figures within the political establishment, from judges to jurymen. One attack in particular is quite brutal. This is an attack against a juryman called Dennis Field, in which Dennis Field will be stabbed in the throat with a sword cane. He'll be stabbed in the tongue. He will be stabbed in the hip. He'll be stabbed all over his body. He will have to feign death. The Invincibles will then leave the scene. With the attack on Dennis Field, the juryman, the police and the state now use a section of the Coercion Act which is going to establish what's known as the Star Chamber of Inquiry. This was an inquisition. This inquisition essentially was that you had to be brought in front of a judge, or you had to be brought in front of a justice of the peace, and if you refused to cooperate with that inquisition, you were going to be arrested. You were going to be jailed for it.
Shane, could you tell us why jurors became targets for the Invincibles at this time?
Well, there's a process of packing juries. The whole idea was that we have to secure by luck or by crook or by hook, we have to secure all these individuals by any means possible. And the best way to do this was to have a panel of loyal metropolitan Protestant citizens, more or less. In terms of the jury system of the time, if you were Roman Catholic or if you were nationalist orientated, equally if you were Protestant or you were nationalist orientated, you were essentially pushed aside, and the jury was filled with those who were unionist orientated, loyalist orientated, who were determined supporters of the state as well. The whole attitude was that you had to secure these executions or these trials or convictions by any means whatsoever. It's an underhand strategy, but it's something that was always done in Ireland. That's quite interesting in that regard to think about it, because it's while Ireland is part of the United Kingdom at this stage, as you see with the Dynamite campaign as well, you can get away with things in Ireland that you wouldn't get away with in Britain itself. The likes of packing juries, the use of spies, agents provocateurs, and the use of informants within political movements. That's incredibly embedded in both the response to the Invincibles and the Fenian Dynamite campaign.
I think it says something about the essentially colonial nature of the administration in Ireland.
Very much so. Like, Ireland is seen as a colony. It's seen as part of Britain, but it's not as British as Bristol. Mm-hmm. It is very much so a colony, and there's this colonial attitude to it that we have to deal with colonials. The only way we can deal with colonials is to undermine these secret societies. And the only way you can undermine their secret societies is exactly what they do in India. It's exactly what they do in China. It's exactly what they do in Ireland in the 1920s as well. And even the present day, you send in spies, informants, agents provocateurs, and they undermine the solidarity of these movements, and you break the solidarity. Now, in terms of the Invincibles, there weren't really a lot of spies or informants within it. They're all fairly dedicated individuals with inside of it. They're all active Fenians, including James Carey. James Carey was the most militant-minded Republican you could possibly meet. they're just tricked, or they're so horrified by what takes place in the Phoenix Park that they decide to actually offer information to the police and the state.
Before we get into the gruesome demise of the Invincibles, what was the relationship of the Invincibles to the wider Fenian movement? Mm-hmm. Because back in the 1860s, I remember reading, and you did have the Clerkenwell explosion and you had various shootings of policemen and informers, but generally speaking, the Fenians of that era said, we're not for terrorism, so-called, we're for open warfare. So how did the general Fenian movement perceive these Invincibles and what they were doing?
Well, a lot of people will wrongly tell you that the Invincibles were an offshoot of the Fenians. That's one thing that incredibly annoys me about Irish history today. The Invincibles were not an offshoot of the Fenians. The Invincibles were all Fenians. They were an assassination committee that were established within the Fenian network. The ambition of which was really to make a living hell for the British administration in Ireland. The whole idea was to assassinate these leading figures. And in terms of what's going on in the country at the time as well, there's a lot of Fenians who are involved in the assassinations of the landlords. There's a lot of Fenians who are involved in the assassinations of Gombeen men as well. Equally, the Invincibles don't have that in Dublin. So they go after the political elite. They go after the political establishment. There are many within the upper echelons of the Fenian movement who are absolutely horrified by what takes place. They're absolutely disgusted by what takes place. In the context of society at the time, never have two administrators of any country in the world been so brutally assassinated. The assassinations involve 11-inch surgical knives. The bodies are torn to shreds. So never has this ever taken place in society.
11 inches is like a big butcher's knife kind of thing.
I was just wondering, what is the significance of assassinating them with butcher's knives rather than coming up beside them with pistols and shooting them straight out?
The reason why they use these surgical knives is because there was the whole idea that they'd be quieter as opposed to using guns. So it's quieter to assassinate them using the knives as opposed to the guns. Now, one of the reasons why they're so controversial within Irish history is the sense that they use knives. Had they used guns, would they still be as vilified as they are today? Will they still be as controversial within the Irish historical narrative as they are today? Like, let's put it into context. Michael Collins sends individuals out to shoot people in the back of a head in a tram. Mm-hmm. Michael Collins sends individuals out to shoot people in their beds.
And he did try to kill the Lord Lieutenant French in 1919, which would have been the same. In the Phoenix Park, or near the Phoenix Park.
Near enough to the
as a matter of fact.
Yeah. But Collins today is seen by most of us in the state as a hero. Collins is seen as a figure who was the great Michael Collins, who sent out these men to assassinate individuals left, right and centre in public view, in public sight, in the streets of Dublin, made Dublin an incredibly dangerous place. But had the likes of Vinnie Byrne used a knife, had Collins had sent Vinnie Byrne out to assassinate a man using a knife, would Collins or would one of his 12 apostles be seen as the heroes that they're seen today? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the difference between the Invincibles, who assassinate two men using knives quite brutally, or between Michael Collins, who sends an individual out to assassinate a man to shoot him in the head on a tram? Mm-hmm. What's the difference in that regard? And that's something that history needs to address. An individual still loses his life. Mm-hmm. And that's incredibly important in terms of history.
Two more small questions on this topic. One was, what you constantly see in the later period is references back to the Fenian IRB constitution of 1879, mm-hmm. where they said they wouldn't go for more insurrection until they had the backing of the people. So where did that come into, if you like, small group violence that was going on in the early 1880s?
Fenianism is not a unitary movement. The Supreme Council is the head of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, but it is a top-down organisation in theory. But in reality, it's more of a grassroots organisation. It's more based on, in terms of, it's similar to the 1920s in the sense that local commanders do what they want to do, whereas GHQ don't really know what local commanders are doing. In terms of the Fenians themselves in the 1860s and the 1880s, the 1870s, you do have a grassroots that are willing to do what they want to do themselves. In terms of Dublin, this is done without the authority of the Supreme Council. The Invincibles don't have the authority of the Supreme Council of the Irish Republican Brotherhood. The Supreme Council will be quite stolidly against what takes place in Dublin. The likes of John O'Leary will be horrified by what takes place in the Phoenix Park. They view their means of warfare as this legitimate warfare. Two open armies fighting each other, wearing two recognisable uniforms in an open battleground. They don't like this whole idea of a clandestine war in the shadows involving small-scale individuals, a guerrilla war that's designed to undermine the state itself. Their attitude is that only allows the media to portray us all as murderers, to portray us all as criminals, to portray us all as these ham-fisted revolutionaries who are not prepared to actually make a real sacrifice in terms of going out into a battlefield and fighting a recognisable army. Many others will argue, however, well, why should we do that? You know, we can wait till British difficulty becoming Ireland's opportunity, till the cows come home. It's not going to happen. Equally, history has shown that a recognisable army such as the Fenians in the 1867 rebellion, such as the United Irishmen in 1798, they could never defeat the far superior military resources of the British Army. And the only way to do so was to use an underground campaign of violence, direct political arbitrary violence directed against the state. And when the Fenians get involved in terms of their dynamite campaign, roughly around the same period, it's a campaign more or less of what we today would call terror. To undermine the state by means of terrifying the people and then forcing the people to challenge the government itself.
Okay, so having provided some of the context, the Invincibles have been turned, some of them. James Carey's turned in custody into an informer. What happens then?
Carey, it's an incredible story how they turn James Carey. James Carey is really a militant Republican. Carey refuses to talk. Carey wants nothing to do with John Mallon. But there's a whole incessant psychological warfare that's applied to James Carey. It really is a remarkable story in policing how they crack him. They'll wake him up abruptly, early in the morning. They leave the spy hole in his door slightly ajar. Feet will then go marching past the door. The cell that James Carey is held in Camanham Jail, if anyone's familiar with it today, it's Robert Emmett's prison cell in Camanham Jail, directly opposite the prison cell where Charles Stuart Parnell is today. He'll hear footsteps walking down the corridor. As the footsteps are walking down the corridor, he'll look out the spy hole that's been left slightly open, that's been left slightly ajar. He'll see police walking into the cell beside him with papers under their arm. The police would then be followed by the Crown Solicitor, the notorious George Bolton. John Mallon would then be seen going inside to the prison cell as well. They'd be in there for a while. Carey was left to panic inside the prison cell. The whole idea is then spread that someone is talking. Carey then gets to talk to the guard who's standing outside his prison cell, and he wants to know who's talking, where they're going inside of that prison cell. He's told by the prison guard, "Someone in your company is talking. I don't have the authority to tell you who's talking." He then demands to see John Mallon. He tells John Mallon, "Listen, I want to tell you anything that I know, if it's going to save my life." Mallon doesn't have any interest. Mallon does, however, allow Carey to write a letter to his wife. While he allows Carey to write a letter to his wife, when Mallon goes to Carey's wife, a lady called Maggie, Mallon tells Carey's wife that Daniel Curley is talking and that Daniel Curley is going to see your husband hang. He then gives her a pen, he then gives her paper, and he says, "Write a letter to your husband." Maggie Carey writes a letter to her husband, in which it basically says, "I don't want you to die. Daniel Curley is going to tell everything that he knows about you. He's going to see you hanged. Tell John Mallon everything you know." Carey reads this. He pleads with John Mallon. Mallon doesn't want to know. What Carey doesn't know is that Daniel Curley has refused to talk. Daniel Curley is not speaking. Daniel Curley is not opening his mouth to John Mallon. Eventually, Mallon goes away. He lets Carey stew for a couple of days. Carey then cracks again under the pressure. He's then left alone and isolated inside of Kilmainham Jail. Then Mallon miraculously comes back. And when Mallon comes back, he decides to have a change of heart. And he decides to listen what Carey has to say. And then Carey tells him everything he knows about the Invincibles. And essentially when Carey turns, it really is the tide turning against the Invincibles. Before Carey had turned, there were several minor informers that gave information about the assassinations and the conspiracy. But James Carey really is that celebrity witness, that supergrass, to use a modern term, that will essentially undermine the very nature of the solidarity of the Invincibles. And it was recalled that when Carey was brought into Kilmainham Courthouse, right beside Kilmainham Jail, that Joe Brady was like a tiger on a spring. And had Brady have actually grabbed him inside, the whole fear was that Brady would have grabbed him and pulled him inside to the dock and would have stamped on his head. That was the big fear of the time. And if anyone has ever been inside of Kilmainham Courthouse, you notice that where the dock is, it's right beside where the witness box is. So it would have been an incredible scene for Carey just to walk right past his comrades, or former comrades, to sit in that dock. And he kept his back to them while he's in that dock. Such was the shame and the humiliation that he himself felt for what he did. Now, Carey himself always had a lifelong hatred of the informer. Bear in mind, he was part of a Fenian vigilance committee that was rooted to get out informers. Carey himself saved a couple of lives in his trial. In particular, he saved the life of Mary Byrne, Frank Byrne's wife. Frank Byrne had given the knives to Mary Byrne, who was heavily pregnant, to smuggle over to Ireland, to hide them in her petticoats. Byrne had speculated that the police would never search a heavily pregnant woman. And as a result, Carey came into contact with Mary Byrne. When Mary Byrne was brought over to Ireland to stand trial in Kilmainham Courthouse, James Carey didn't know her. He denied that that was Mary Byrne in the stand. Well, this was obviously the Mary Byrne that he himself had met. So in a sense, to play devil's advocate for Carey, Carey did actually save her life. He did actually save her from imprisonment. Carey's big argument was that he was no informer and that he only gave information on those who actually deserved to die, on those who were actually guilty of committing the assassinations. That was Carey's argument, true and true. He still remained within his own twisted psychology, a very staunch Republican in many regards, despite the fact that he had seen five men hang on information that he had gave in Killiam Jail.
We're just going to take a very quick break.
The executions themselves were rather brutal, I believe.
The executions were incredibly brutal. The executions take place between May to June 1883. In total, five men will be executed in Kilmainham Jail. You have Joe Brady the first, then you have Daniel Curley the second, followed by Michael Fagan, then followed by Thomas Caffrey and Timothy Kelly. Of them all, really, the most controversial execution was the first one, of Joseph Brady. Brady was hanged in Kilmainham Jail by William Marwood. Marwood was a celebrity of his time. After Brady was hanged, there's a little known, rather forgotten about story within Irish history. John Mallon, the policeman who broke the Invincibles, is seen leaving Kilmainham Jail. He's seen leaving Kilmainham Jail by a friend of his, a man called Frederick Moore Bousset. As he's leaving Kilmainham Jail by Frederick Moore Bousset, who's a French journalist who's working in Dublin covering the trials and the executions of the Invincibles, Moore Bousset approaches his friend. He wants to ask John Mallon, basically, is there any story you can give me? Did Joe Brady make a final statement? Did he give any kind of statement? Did he make anything remarkable? Did anything happen? Mallon was as white as a ghost, according to Moore Bousset. And Mallon dismissed him. He was incredibly rude to him. He wanted nothing to do with Moore Bousset. He then jumped into a waiting police cab and he drove away at speed, escorted by a heavy police escort toward Dublin City. Moore Bousset noted that Mallon had something in his hand. That something was covered in a table napkin. Later on in the 20th century, Moore Bousset wrote a book on John Mallon. In that book on John Mallon, he recalled that he met the policeman and he asked him, "Why so many years ago, at the execution of Joseph Brady, were you so rude to me? Why were you in such a hurry to get away?" According to Moore Bousset, Mallon is reported to have said, "Do you not remember the tablecloth I had? Joseph Brady's head was in that tablecloth." Joseph Brady was beheaded, according to history, by the Kilmainham Jail doctor, a man called Dr. William Cart. Dr. William Cart had ordered John Mallon to deliver the head to the Royal College of Surgeons.
So they cut off his head for what purpose?
For phrenology. The whole idea was to study his brain to see if there are any lumps or any bumps that would indicate that the individual was predestined towards some degree of criminality or subversion. Equally, of all the Invincibles to have been executed as well, the second last man, Thomas Caffrey, he died really the most tragic death. William Marwood, the man who executed the Invincibles, believed that he was simply there to take the person's life on the basis that that person had taken someone else's life or had committed a serious crime. He was strongly the belief that it was not for him to cause any pain to the individual. Marwood understood that when you're hanging a person, there's a whole process to hanging somebody. They have to measure the weight against the height and the predicted speed of the drop. Marwood understood that if you miscalculate, there's a possibility that you could either pull the prisoner's head right off the prisoner's body, causing a great degree of pain, or you could simply strangle the prisoner to death, leaving him alive for up to half an hour, feeling his body die. The whole idea was to cause spinal rupture, break the neck, separate the head from the spine, killing the prisoner instantly with no pain whatsoever. On this occasion, however, with Thomas Caffrey, Marwood miscalculated. As a result, Caffrey will die of asphyxiation. Caffrey will die quite a painful death. Ironically, for Thomas Caffrey, of all the five to have been executed inside of Kilmainham Jail, the only one to have suffered was actually the only one to have shown some degree of sorrow for what took place in the Phoenix Park. He was the only one to have actually pleaded guilty to being involved in the assassinations on May 6th, 1882. Now, the five men are still buried inside of Kilmainham Jail today. In many respects, this raises a question within Irish history. Should they still be inside of Kilmainham Jail today? Their sentence essentially was that they were supposed to be inside of Kilmainham Prison while that building remained a prison. Kilmainham Jail today is clearly not a prison. It's a tourist attraction. After 130 years, they really shouldn't be there today. Nobody should still be in Kilmainham Jail today. Throughout that jail today, there are scattered graves of so many people in times past have largely been forgotten by means of history. The Invincibles are featured quite heavily in that. Now, the Invincibles will be buried in quicklime, but quicklime only dissolves the skin, doesn't dissolve the bones. There will be remnants of the Invincibles down there today. Now, should the Invincibles still be in Kilmainham Jail? I personally don't think they should be. I think that they should be removed from that prison, and this should be done by means of involvement with all the relatives of the Invincibles themselves, also with the relatives of Lord Frederick Cavendish and Thomas Henry Burke, and also with a number of political initiatives too. The Invincibles really should be taken out and placed in consecrated ground, as opposed to still being within a former prison today.
Now, did Mallon keep a very grisly memento of the executions?
That's right. Mallon always kept the tip of Joseph Brady's spine as a souvenir, just to say that this was me. This was me who broke the Invincibles. And his party trick was to take it out of his jacket pocket, his inside jacket pocket, to kind of say to people, this is Joseph Brady's spine. Incredible story when you think about it.
I think we should also mention as well, and you brought it up there at the recent conference, that when we talk about the Invincibles and what happened in the Phoenix Park, it's not really often mentioned what happened in Ballina that led up to that.
Very true. On the 5th of May, 1882, the day before the Phoenix Park assassinations, a boys' brass band had come out to celebrate the release of prisoners who'd been arrested under coercion. These were the likes of Charles Stuart Parnell, John Dillon and Michael Davitt. When they were released, the boys' brass band took to the streets of Ballina. When they reached High Street, the RIC, the police force of the time, had tried to stop them. They seized their flutes, they seized their drums, they seized any kind of musical instrument that they had. A number of boys now threw stones at the police. In throwing stones at the police response was very heavy-handed. The police now decided to charge the boys. They injured over 7 boys, all of whom were under the age of 16. 2 of them were killed, and 2 of them were killed quite brutally. In some cases, the hands were crushed. They'd been run over by police. In other cases, their arms had nearly been taken off. Their head had been stamped in. Incredibly brutal what took place. Now, that's referred to in the time, in the contemporary media, as the Ballina Massacre. And many Invincibles and many Fenians often saw that as justification for what took place in the Phoenix Park, because a number of boys had... children, school kids, had been attacked by the state itself. Now, in terms of the history of the Invincibles, I challenge you to look at a book on the Invincibles that actually brings up the Ballina incident. It never actually is features in most books in the Invincibles. It's something that's written out of the history of the Invincibles. And the Invincibles as a society, they really need to be contextualised within the society within which they emerged. The Invincibles are incredibly brutal. No one can deny that. Everyone can agree that what happened in the Phoenix Park on the 6th of May 1882 was possibly wrong. It was incredibly brutal. 2 individuals will lose their life quite brutally because of it, which never should happen. But equally, the society in which they emerge in the 1880s is an incredibly brutal society. That's underlined by incredible brutality from all sides. You also have a situation that's taking place in the country in terms of coercion. Coercion is seen very heavily as tyranny. And the Invincibles want to respond to coercion by any means possible. And this is one of their means of doing so, to assassinate these 2 leading figures. Unfortunately for Cavendish, however, Cavendish was unlucky. Cavendish was in the wrong place at the wrong time. The Invincibles had tried to assassinate Thomas Henry Burke. Mm-hmm. Cavendish, unfortunately, by being in the Phoenix Park on the 6th of May 1882, trying to defend his friend, Thomas Henry Burke, would himself have been assassinated.
We today, as you mentioned, would call this terrorism. I mean, you've got a state against... generally weak unarmed movement, and acts of great public import are used to terrify the elite. We've talked about the Phoenix Park killings, which are possibly the most shocking, but they're pretty much directly followed by a bombing campaign by some Fenians in Britain itself. Can you say something about that?
The Fenian Dynamite Campaign, it really goes on between 1881 to 1885. It really is the world's first modern bombing campaign in Great Britain. It is essentially what we today would consider a terrorist campaign. Though the term terrorism is a very pejorative term, it's not really the best term to describe it, but for the 20th century and the 21st, it probably is the best term.
We still don't have a better term, unfortunately.
Exactly.
But as we're talking here about the technique, not the judgment, I think.
Exactly. Now, in terms of what they do, the Fenian Dynamite Campaign emerges really in 1876 by means of a letter that arrives in a newspaper in Irish America. This letter that arrives in a newspaper called the Irish World calls for a revolutionary fund to be established to keep the faith alive, to keep the fire burning. After the failure of the 1860s, Fenianism falls into stagnancy in the 1870s. Everyone generally doesn't know where Fenianism is going to go. The movement is incredibly divided. In America, it's fallen into party politics. O'Donovan Ross eulogises this idea to set up a revolutionary fund. This eventually becomes known as what's called the Skirmishing Fund. And the idea is to raise money to have these direct arbitrary attacks, this direct arbitrary violence within Britain. Now, in January 1881, you're going to find that the Fenians will mount their first bombing campaign in Britain. They'll mount their first explosion. This is the first ever explosion to ever take place in the United Kingdom for a political grievance. This takes place at Salford Barracks in Manchester. The choice of Salford is quite apt on the basis that this is where the Manchester martyrs would have been hanged a couple of years beforehand. In this occasion, the Fenian dynamiters, who are referred to in this time as the dynamitards, that's a 19th century term for terrorist, the dynamitards, absolutely great term. The dynamitards attack the King's regiment at Manchester. In doing so, they leave a gunpowder explosive outside the barrack wall. However, At the time, unfortunately, a seven-year-old boy will be passing by with his nanny. That seven-year-old boy was called Richard Clark. Richard Clark will be killed. He will die as a result of a brain hemorrhage from shrapnel that will hit his head in the course of that explosion. His nanny will be left permanently deaf and injured afterwards as well. The Fenian Dynamite campaign will continue on. Each explosion seems to be getting closer and closer to London, the very centre of the citadel of the British Empire. The Fenian Dynamite campaign is largely maintained by two organisations within Fenianism. It's maintained by Clan na Gael, which is the major organisation within Fenianism, and a dissident group involved with Clan na Gael that will break away from the clan over what's known as the New Departure with Charles Stuart Parnell. This dissident group is centred around Jeremiah O'Donovan Rossa, and they're referred to as the Skirmishers. Now, the Skirmishers are undermined by means of bad funding. The Skirmishers don't have the money to maintain a serious dynamite campaign. Clan na Gael has the money to maintain a serious dynamite campaign. But the Skirmishers genuinely believe that if they continue their little, minor dynamite campaign, which will continue right up to the spring of 1883, they can force the more powerful Clan na Gael into this more militant, more nihilistic war of attrition in Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea was that when it comes to the point that either they would take over from Clan na Gael in America, the Skirmishers would, or either Clan na Gael would then move to oust the Skirmishers, and Clan na Gael would use its might to then take over control of the Fenian Dynamite campaign. Now, really, the only success story of the Skirmishers really takes place in 1883, both in January and March 1883. In January 1883, they maintain three simultaneous explosions in Glasgow, and they turn the entire city of Glasgow into pitch darkness as well by means of attacking a gas works at Treddeston in Glasgow. They also planned to blow up a bridge over Postle Road. This bridge over Postle Road contained a canal. This would have been a retributive attack. It would have been quite a brutal attack as well had they have done it. Had they have blown down the bridge, it would have flooded a loyalist district of Glasgow. This loyalist district included many Orangemen as well in the area. So it was seen as a direct reprisal, a sectarian attack against a local unionist community within Glasgow city itself. So in some respects, it was mixed up with Irish politics. But the skirmishing campaign itself and the Fenian Dynamite campaign was largely American as opposed to Irish. And that has to be seen in that context as well. In March of 1883, in retaliation for the trials of the Invincibles in Kilmainham Jail, they will carry out two explosions in the administrative centre of London at a place called Whitehall. The Whitehall explosions take place. The first one is a diversionary attack. The diversionary attack takes place at the office of the Times in London. While people are mustering themselves to react to the diversionary attack at the Times, the dynamitards have now attacked the local government board. They mistook the local government board to be the Home Office. The reason why they had intended to attack the Home Office was because the Home Office was the institution that was directly in charge of the maintenance of law and order in Ireland. This was the seat of British power in Ireland, the Home Office. Without the Home Office, Dublin Castle couldn't essentially function. On top of that as well, the Home Office was also the state response to the Fenian Dynamite campaign as well. The Whitehall explosion that takes place in 1883 will essentially force Clan na Gael to do its own explosion. By the fall of 1882, early 1883, they will have an individual functioning within London. This individual is called Dr. Thomas Gallagher. Dr. Thomas Gallagher will also be involved with a man called Alfred Whitehead. His real name is James J. Murphy. Alfred Whitehead will set up a shop in Birmingham. This shop is a paint shop. The reason why he sets up a paint shop is because you can buy materials that are necessary for the production of explosives for legitimate reasons and for legitimate concerns. In this endeavour, Gallagher will also have two gophers. These gophers are a man called William Lynch, another man who's very famous to Irish history, a man called Thomas James Clark, the first signatory of the Easter Proclamation of 1916. Clark will be involved in ferrying tons upon tons of dynamite to London from this dynamite shop in Birmingham. However, they will be watched by police in doing so, and the police will eventually crack the dynamite cell. Thomas Clark will be arrested in 17 Nelson Square in London. The first clan involvement in the Fenian Dynamite campaign will have been a failure. However, they will increase their game throughout the 1884, throughout the later half of 1883, and again in 1885, particularly in October 1883, when they would carry out an explosion on the London Underground Railway at a place called Parade Street, and they will injure over 72 people in that explosion. They will also carry out what's known as Dynamite Saturday in January 1885, when in broad daylight, for the first time in history, they will explode a bomb in the seat of the House of Commons itself. In that, they will explode a bomb in the chamber of the House of Commons, also nearly simultaneously in the Tower of London. In the 1970s, that exact strategy is again applied by the Provisional IRA in the 1980s, when they explode a bomb similarly in the Tower of London and also again in the chamber of the House of Commons. And in many respects, it shows you that Irish history is full circle.
How do the actions of the Fenians in this period, how do they inspire other revolutionary movements throughout Europe?
Well, I would be strongly of the opinion that the Fenians are the progenitor of modern terrorism, as we'd call it. Many people always argue that it's the Russians. But if you look at what the Russians do, in likes of the Narodnaya Volya, the whole idea is that you assassinate political elites, kind of similar to the Invincibles in that regard. Whereas the Fenians actually have a new policy, where you get a bomb, you disguise it in a bag, you use a timer, you set the timer for a certain time, you then deposit it in a cloakroom, you deposit it in a bin, you deposit it in a theatre, then you disappear. And then that gives you enough time to get away. That gives you enough time to run away from the bomb, and also, in a sense, that gives you an alibi as well, that you weren't in the scene. It's not this loose, sporadic attack that the Russians or other European revolutionaries would use and direct against political elites. The Fenians had attempted a sustained bombing campaign, and this is a sustained bombing campaign between 1881 to 1885. It's a sustained bombing campaign that's directed against symbolic institutions, against public transport, against the very nature of the state itself. And the whole idea was to cause what we again today would term terrorism, to cause terror, and this terror would then seek to undermine the very nature of the state by fostering an idea within public mentalities that the state cannot protect us. And then the people will then try and push the government to do something on Ireland. Or equally, on the other hand, in many respects, you also have the idea of propaganda by deed, which is floating about in Europe at the time as well. This idea that by committing these actions, then the state would have a heavy hand response against the people. And then this would force the people to rise themselves.
ETA in the Basque Country have a great phrase for this. They used to call it action, repression, action.
Okay.
Yep. It's called, it's the essence of terrorism, I think, if you like.
But how does this affect relations between Irish people living in Britain and the native British population?
For the first time in Irish history, if you can believe it or not, I have stuff that I found in archives that essentially says that signs have now appeared in shops that say no Irish need apply for jobs. We have cases of Irishmen being chased off the docks in London, being chased out of their work. We have very famous Irish politicians, very famous names in Irish history. A.M. Sullivan, for example, will denounce the Fenian Dynamite campaign, and will talk about how it's easy for those in America, in the safety of America, to be throwing over all these bombs over and across London when they don't actually have to live in London under the name of an Irish person. There was a big attitude there that the Irish are essentially all terrorists and we shouldn't have anything to do with them. There is a big degree of fear as well. Many people will tell you, if you're reading the books of this, of the Fenian Dynamite campaign, it will often say that essentially the British people were not afraid, that they had that bulldog spirit, you know, that stiff upper lip. That was never really the case. I have evidence there that after every bombing, the stock exchange collapsed in certain areas that were attacked. So the likes of when the London Underground was attacked, stocks fell in the London Underground railways. That to me indicates there's terror. Equally, when they blow up Victoria Station, the inside of Victoria Station, the company who owned Victoria Station, the Brighton and South Coast Railway, their stocks opened flat the following day. There's big fear within the country. There's a lot of fear that's gone on at the case at the time. As the Fenian Dynamite campaign progresses onwards, maybe many people are beginning to realise, well, not that many people have been killed. So maybe as you get more used to it, you don't get afraid of it. You still continue to go about your daily life. But there still is that degree of fear that's still there as a result of the Dynamite campaign. And that has a bad effect on the Irish community in London itself as well.
It's actually surprising how few people are killed.
Very few people are killed in it. Now, what the Fenians do is that they most of their explosions take place at the dead of night, for the most part, with the exception of Dynamite Saturday. The only people to have been killed in the Fenian Dynamite campaign were the 7-year-old boy Richard Clark and three dynamitards themselves, led by a man called William Mackie Lomasy, who had intended to blow up the London Bridge network and cause economic chaos in London. Their bomb exploded prematurely under London Bridge, and as a result they were blown to atoms, to quote John Devoy. One man is allegedly to have died. In the primary sources that I have, it indicates that one man had died. There was a reverend of a London church who had complained to his local MP that a woman had been left destitute because of the death of her husband as a result of the Fenian bombing. But there's no other evidence that I've seen to suggest that anyone else had died, and I can't find anything to indicate that another civilian had been killed. As far as I'm concerned, only one person was killed, and that was Richard Clark. But there is a possibility there was someone else, but there's no hard evidence to suggest it.
You mentioned before that the likes of John Devoy in America and James Stevens in Ireland, or John O'Leary in Ireland, yep. the head of the IRB in Ireland, didn't really like this kind of strategy of political violence. At what point did the Fenians kind of turn away from this idea?
James Stevens was horrified by the concept of dynamite campaign. Stevens saw this as the most wicked, the most vile conception of a national movement. Stevens always argued, he came from the Victorian conception of warfare that was schooled in the thought that this was two recognisable armies.
The 1867 generation, yeah.
Exactly. You know, two recognisable armies fighting on a recognisable open playing field, essentially, that you know who is who. In terms of the secret war, it's not a gentlemanly thing to do. Mm. It could be anyone. You could have anyone in the streets. They're not recognisable. They're not really doing what a legitimate army does as well. They're doing what a secret, clandestine...
Cowardly outrage, I believe, is the term of the time.
Exactly, and that's the way Stevens would have perceived it. John Devoy would like us all to believe that he himself perceived it as cowardly outrage, and but John Devoy himself, you know, was no stranger to the Fenian Dynamite campaign. John Devoy was against the concept of the Dynamite campaign in principle. In reality, he was willing to embrace it. And I have a lot of evidence in my new book that's coming out, War in the Shadows, that essentially Devoy himself is hook, line and sinker involved in this Dynamite campaign, particularly in relation to the case of John Daly in 1884, when John Daly had received bombs from Johnny Breslin and John Devoy in America. And these bombs were facilitated into Britain by British intelligence to allow for John Daly to be arrested himself and to be set up, essentially. But while these bombs were facilitated into Britain by British intelligence, the key thing is that John Breslin sent them over, and that was sent over with the knowledge of John Devoy. Mm-hmm. John Devoy is in contact with John Daly while John Daly is in England on some degree of Fenian errand in 1884. The British give a great quote about John Daly, that he was the most bloody-minded fanatic since Guy Fawkes. John Daly's plan was actually to blow up and assassinate the British House of Commons in session by dropping grenades from the visitors' gallery on top of the government front bench. And John Devoy was involved in that.
By the 1890s, or certainly by 1900, this was a thing of the past, though, this kind of campaign. So at what point did Fenianism abandon?
It never really abandoned it in some respects. What takes place in terms of... they're a victim of their own success in 1885. After Dynamite Saturday, when that takes place, when they detonate these two simultaneous bombs in the Tower of London, also in the House of Commons, increasingly America becomes a dangerous place for Fenianism. Increasingly American political elites are beginning to argue, well, if they can blow up a bomb in the British House of Commons, what's to stop them from doing it in Capitol Hill? Yeah. We need to move against these guys. There's increasing talk that there's going to be... treaties of extradition between Britain and America at this stage as well. This is now beginning to frighten Fenianism. There's also the growth of the Irish Parliamentary Party as well. Many within the Irish Parliamentary Party are increasingly very vocal, and it's increasingly looking likely that the Irish Parliamentary Party is going to get some degree of home rule or some guarantee of home rule. And that in the 1885 general election that they do quite well. The Irish Parlamentary Party knows that Clanagail's involved with Dynamite. They know very strongly that there's some connection there with Clannagale in terms of Dynamite attacks in London and the Clan. They are pleading with Clannagale to hold back. Hold on to your arms. Do not cause us any trouble. Clannagale in 1885 issues a circular, and this basically says no more Dynamite attacks until the exigencies of the Constitutional Party are over. Hmm. And that essentially means 1885 general election. The 1885 general election is a huge success for Parnell. It's a huge success for the Parnellites. They don't get the balance of power, but they very nearly get that balance of power. It's increasingly looking likely the Home Rule is going to become a reality in the 1880s. And they realise in Irish America that if they do a Dynamite campaign again, if they continue that Dynamite campaign, then this is going to cause a problem for the Parliamentary Party, that they won't get that idea of Home Rule. And increasingly, many will increasingly begin to argue that essentially greater rewards can be achieved by working within the system as opposed to working without the system. There are those, however, who will still maintain the idea of a Dynamite campaign. In 1887, there's a Jubilee plot to assassinate Queen Victoria at the height of her Jubilee. This is a British government-inspired plot that involves several agent provocateurs. In the 1890s, there's a further Dynamite campaign that takes place. This Dynamite campaign involves many figures who will be known to the Invincibles as well, including Patrick Tynan, the notorious number one of the Invincible conspiracy. Again, it petters out. It's not really that serious. In the aftermath of the Phoenix Park assassinations, the British government sets up a permanent secret service department in Ireland. This permanent secret service department is set up in Dublin Castle. It's known as the Assistant Undersecretary for Police and Crime. Initially, it's led by a man called Colonel Henry Brackenbury. Colonel Henry Brackenbury, however, wants to leave the Assistant Undersecretary for Police and Crime to go fighting in Egypt. He's a military man at heart. He wants to fight against resurgent Egyptian nationalism. As a result, he leaves. He's left in disgrace. He's now replaced by a man called Edward George Jenkinson. Edward George Jenkinson really is a spy master general. Jenkinson has a circus of spies, agents provocateurs all encircling around him, his most notorious of which was a man called Red Jim McDermott. And Jenkinson, through Red Jim McDermott, will see that several men will be arrested in a bogus dynamite plot in Cork in 1883. The whole idea is to undermine the solidarity of these movements, get into the movements, work your way inside of it as a mole, as an agent provocateur, and push these individuals to the point that they become dangerous. When they become dangerous, you then allow them to be arrested. And then this gives the impression that the state is actually doing a lot of good in terms of breaking down the any form of conspiracy or any form of challenge, whether it's the Invincibles or whether it's the Dynamitards. The use, however, of spies and agent provocateurs raises a significant question in terms of the British state's response to this idea of Fenian conspiracy in the 1880s. In terms of morality, it's a particular moral question. The moral question essentially is, what point are you causing terrorism or what point are you preventing terrorism from taking place? Essentially as well, to have an agent provocateur involved in the movement, that agent provocateur, that British agent, has to carry out and maintain criminal activity. And that has to be maintained and carried out under the supervision of the state. And how far can the handler allow that individual to carry out and maintain this criminal or subversive activity? That's an incredibly important point, and that moral question will continue to dog British intelligence's response to Fenian conspiracy in this period, right up until the fall of Jenkinson in 1886, when Jenkinson essentially is ousted from his position as the spymaster general in Britain and in Ireland as a result of his clandestine, dirty war against Fenianism between 1883 right up until 1886.
Well, I think, Shane, we should also mention the conditions that the men who were convicted during the Dynamite campaign, that the conditions that they served their prison sentences under.
The conditions were absolutely atrocious that they served their conditions under. And the Victorian prison system is an incredibly brutal prison system compared to our own prison system today. It's a silent system. You never speak, you never make eye contact, you never look, you never talk at anybody. If you do so, you'd be severely punished. Thomas Clark writes very much so about this in his book Glimpses of an Irish Prison Felon's Life. Absolutely incredible read, if you ever get a chance to read of it. Clark will recall that the Fenian Dynamitards were treated as special men. And these special men were treated to some of the lowest contempt within the prison system. They were forced to do degrading work. Several of them will lose their sanity. Thomas Clark recalled that his good friend Alfred Whitehead, the man in charge of the Birmingham Dynamite Factory, that Alfred Whitehead would lose his sanity. Alfred Whitehead each night would start cursing from his highest voice to hell with Britain. He would start cursing himself. He would plead to God that he was not going insane. Dr. Thomas Gallagher was recalled as going in as a fair-haired dandy. He came out as a man with sunken cheeks. He was bald. He was insane. He will die in a mental asylum. He increasingly believed himself to have been God. Murphy himself, Alfred Whitehead, will have went on the run when he got out of prison. He will believe that he was being chased by the British. He's eventually found in Cork, where he originally came from. He's eventually found by his sisters in there, but he refuses to go with his sisters, and he has to be tied down while he's in the boat going from Cove to America. Like, there's incredible treatment that they suffer, and the treatment that they get is absolutely horrendous while they're in jail.
Well, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. We're very glad to have been joined by Dr. Shane Kenna. Thank you very much for coming in, Shane. You should keep an eye out for Shane's book, War in the Shadows, The Irish-American Fenians Who Bombed Victorian Britain, and that will be published by Merriam Press. And also, Shane's website is
shanekenna.ie. Also has some good articles on the Irish story as well.
Exactly. So thank you from myself, Cathal Brennan, and my co-presenter, John Dorney. Until next time, thank you.